Our next speaker is a speaker who spoke yesterday and who is a long-term friend and respected colleague, Dr. Martin Kroesch. He's the professor of surgery at the University of Tennessee, Memphis, and the director of the trauma program there. Dr. Kroesch will be talking about abdominal wall reconstruction.
Well, thanks. I really enjoy talking about this particular topic, and what I'm going to be talking about is abdominal wall reconstruction for fairly complex hernias that basically I've created. So it's sort of a job security thing. So when you're taking care of some of these trauma patients with massive resuscitation, you can't get their abdomen closed, so it's job security. I have no conflicts to disclose, except for, don't you wish you were part of this million-dollar quartet, which was filmed at Sun Studios, which is in Memphis, and yes, the Trauma Center is named after Elvis Presley. So again, I'm not going to be talking about these relatively straightforward abdominal wall hernias. I'm going to be talking about these sorts of things where you've got the patient's guts, if you wait long enough, they're only being held in by this particular skin graft, and the longer you wait, the more they wind up on the bed. So there's a number of reasons that patients get these particular defects. One of the obvious ones is the patients who undergo abdominal wall resection for whatever reason, either due to necrotizing soft tissue infection or close-range shotgun blasts. And again, as we spoke yesterday, shotguns seem to be out of favor, at least in the Mid-South. So we don't seem to see as many of them. We also don't seem to see as much necrotizing soft tissue infections of the abdominal walls anymore. And I think that's primarily because we leave so many more of these abdomens open, so we're not closing the fascia under tension, which then sort of creates a little smorgasbord for the organisms, especially in contaminated wounds. If you close things under tension, then you get ischemia, and then you get dead tissue, and then the bacteria have a little field day. But nonetheless, so it can be from abdominal wall loss. It can be patients who have a planned re-exploration for whatever reason, either due to intra-abdominal sepsis, diffuse suppurative peritonitis, pancreatitis, second-look operations for vascular insufficiency and the like, and then massive visceral edema. Despite the unbridled enthusiasm for damage control resuscitation that seems to be going on now, I'm a bit hesitant to throw out the great work that Tom Shires did back in the 60s in explaining the pathophysiology of shock and resuscitation, that we need to restore the cellular volume with crystalloid. Do we give too much crystalloid sometimes? Well, yeah, obviously we do. But I don't think we should completely throw out crystalloid resuscitation and just replace it by blood and blood products based on the results of some, frankly, sketchy retrospective data. Nonetheless, again, these are the patients that I'm talking about that really, if you had a crane and a winch, you couldn't get this abdomen closed at the time of the initial operation. So we sort of stumbled upon this abdominal wall reconstruction staged management technique where it's three stages. First is artificial covering of the abdomen, just something to keep the bowels from getting on the bed. Then we wait a couple of weeks or so and then create a planned ventral hernia, and that's by placing a skin graft over the abdomen, removing the prosthetic, placing a skin graft over the abdomen, and then in 8 to 12 months or so, definitively reconstruct the abdominal wall. And I want to briefly go over each stage, and then when we get to the definitive reconstruction part, I've got some little videos that will show how to actually do this operation. If I can do it, it's not really that complicated. So there's a whole bunch of different methods of closure, and whenever there's a whole lot of different ways to do something, that really goes to show that there's not really one good way. Well, I'm going to show you the only good way, and that's the way we do it in Memphis, but which happens to be the only correct way to do things. First is one thing that we use a fair amount of is plastic. It's pretty cheap. You get an X-ray cassette cover that costs about 27 cents or so, and you cut it to fit, and you sew it to the skin. It's nice because you can actually look at the bowels and make sure they're still alive. You can still use this in the face of gauze packing and the like, and it's helpful for planned re-expiration. It doesn't really tolerate very well if you incise the plastic and open up and then sew the plastic back together again, just because the plastics doesn't really hold a stitch too well. But in general, it works fairly well. This slide demonstrates the recommendations for using polypropylene mesh as a temporary abdominal closure. All the advantages are listed here on this particular slide. It's really pretty good if you're going to try to create fistulas, because that's what happens as the if we wait too long to take the polypropylene mesh off. As you can see, this loop of small bowel is just dying to expose its contents. So we don't use polypropylene mesh anymore. We used to because there really weren't a whole lot of options. When I was a resident, that's what we did. And we would wait about a week or 10 days or so, and then we would take the knife handle and scrape off all the granulation as it was coming through the polypropylene mesh, and then carefully dissect off the polypropylene mesh from the underlying viscera. Needless to say, we had about a 20% small bowel fistula rate, which was sort of the going rate at the time. Now it's a bit lower, primarily because we don't do that. And it's not just us, but the group from Louisville years ago showed that the fate of Marlex really results in fistula and extrusion of mesh, and is in general a fairly miserable thing to do. If we use polypropylene mesh in the emergency setting, and this is a summary of reports, again, 20% fistula rate, you still wind up with a hernia. And then when the mesh gets infected over time, it just starts spitting out pieces of that mesh, which is, in general, really very unpleasant. And probably the best way to handle those particular patients is to figure out a way to transfer them to someone else. This slide lists all the recommendations for using PTFE in the acute setting. PTFE is really a good thing. It's great if you play golf when it's wet outside and you have it in your shoes and it keeps your feet dry. And it also helps a lot when you're skiing. And I sort of joke about that because it's got a lot of uses in the medical field, just not for temporary closure of the abdominal wall. It's very effective, but it's, at least at our institution, it's cost prohibitive. Absorbable mesh seems to be a pretty reasonable alternative. It can be used in patients with all sorts of different etiologies of their abdominal wall defect. It can be sewn to the fascia, and you can sort of see, this is a patient who had diffuse suppurative peritonitis, and you can see his bowels are a bit annoyed. We use Vicryl mesh, and it really works pretty well. The probably the latest craze is the vacuum-assisted devices, and these initially described by Don Barker, who's in Chattanooga now, called a VacPack, and now there's a commercially available product that really works very well, and this is probably the greatest thing since sliced bread. These negative pressure devices, there are some that say that if you put these on, then you can get all the abdomens closed, that you don't wind up with planned ventral hernias that require abdominal wall reconstruction. One of our former fellows, Preston Miller at Wake Forest, looked at 53 patients with open abdomens. They were able to get 88% of these patients closed by using negative pressure devices. But that data really hasn't been reproduced. In a multi-institutional trial, looking at 200 patients, that was the etiology of their abdominal wall defect. They tried on 112 patients, and still a third of those patients wound up with incisional hernias. So sometimes if you put the vacuum device on patients that really you can get their fascia closed, and then the next day you take them back and you close it, well, is that a success of the vacuum device, or is that just, which came first, the chicken or the egg? So I think that you can pretty much manipulate that percentage of how many people you can get delayed fascial closure on, depending on what your patient population is. We actually tried to look at this, and over a period of time, looked at there were 17,000 patients admitted. 1,300 of them had emergent laparotomy. There are 250 that were managed with an open abdomen, and of those, 51 met inclusion criteria, and those patients were randomized to receive either a vacuum dressing or the Vicryl mesh temporary dressing. These were the outcomes. We were only able to get less than a third of them closed with delayed fascial closure, and there was a very strict protocol on how often we would try to take these patients and take them to the operating room, put them asleep, and try to get their abdomen closed. We stumbled upon a couple of interesting things. One is that the fistula rate was much higher in patients who had vacuum dressings or vacuum temporary closures than mesh. Well, why would that be? Well, what we found is that it all occurred in patients who had tube enterostomies, either feeding jejunostomies or, as in those with duodenal injuries, twin jejunostomies. Because when you put the vacuum dressing on, you've got to have that plastic down to cover up the bowels to keep them from sticking to the abdominal wall, right? I mean, that's the whole purpose of having the thing. Well, that works pretty well at keeping the bowels from being stuck to the abdominal wall, but if you have a tube enterostomy, you want that bowel stuck to the abdominal wall, right? Because you don't want it to leak. And what we found is that we wound up causing a bunch of leaks by doing that. So now what we've learned, you know, we're not as dumb as we look. We did learn that in patients who have tube enterostomies, they never get a vacuum temporary closure because at least in our hands, we had a much higher fistula rate. So we found benefits of both things in this randomized trial. The vacuum dressing is a lot easier to place and much quicker, but it really had no distinct advantage over the polypropylene mesh at the time, and the fistula rate is less. Each has its own disadvantages. Again, you can't use the vacuum if an enterostomy, and the disadvantage of the mesh primarily is that you wind up putting fascial sutures in order to hold these guts in. You can see from this, it's pretty easy to re-explore someone through the Vicryl mesh. You just cut it, re-explore them, and then just sew it back together again. So again, we weren't unique in that. In looking, this was a study that was done in the British Journal of Surgery. Again, depends on who you look at. This particular group identified 90% of patients that were able to get delayed fascial closure, but at follow-up, a bunch of those patients had hernias. In fact, two-thirds of them had hernias, and only a third of them didn't have a hernia. So remember that now. In these complex abdominal walls, two-thirds of those patients had hernias. Now, stage two, again, occurs anywhere from 2 weeks or so after the last operation, and that's the creation of the planned ventral hernia. And that's where you get a patient that looks like this, and it looks like pretty much these guts are stuck. So if we take this mesh off, this patient is not going to eviscerate. This abdomen is now becoming frozen, and that's really what you want. Because then it's pretty easy to take the skin graft off. It's easy to take the Vicryl mesh off. In fact, it forms a suppurative layer in between the underlying granulation tissue that's just beginning over the bowels and the mesh itself, so it just peels right off. It's really kind of neat. Now, there's a small percentage of patients who have really aggressive granulation tissue that will very rapidly grow through and incorporate that Vicryl mesh. If that's the case, just leave it alone. It's going to dissolve anyway, so it doesn't really matter. But we go ahead and take it off and then put a skin graft on over this. And that then creates the planned ventral hernia. Now, when do you do this? You want to do it sooner rather than later. You want to do it sooner at the point where you're pretty sure the patient's not going to eviscerate when you take the temporary closure off. Because, again, it's problematic when you're, you know, you just get home and then somebody calls and says, yeah, Mr. Gishnerbis just coughed and now his guts are on the bed. And that's the guy that you just put the skin graft on, you know, 3 hours ago. So it's kind of a day ruiner. The patients don't like it very much when their guts are all on the bed. And everybody gets very unhappy and the nurses kind of freak out a little bit and it's just a mess. So just wait till they're stuck, put the skin graft on. If you wait too long, though, If you wait too long and leave the polypropyl or the Vicryl mesh covering the bowels, then you're setting the patient up for fistula. And the longer you wait, the more likely you are to develop a fistula. And that's what we demonstrated here, that with longer absorbable mesh days, we had a much higher incidence of fistula. Now, if you get a fistula, it's not necessarily a bad thing, as long as it becomes controlled, and if it gets small like that, you know, that we sent him home, and he had a pretty low output from this fistula, and then we just eventually brought him back and reconstructed his abdominal wall. So, again, the timing of the fistula developing the open abdomen is depending on how long you wait until you put a skin graft over that abdominal defect. Now, I'm sad to say that this happens to be one of my cases, and one valuable lesson that I learned that I knew, and it's amazing how many times you have to relearn the same stupid things. But when you put the skin graft on, and when you put the first strip down, and then you put the second strip down, don't sew the two pieces together with a very fine piece of 5-0 Vicryl or anything. Just getting a little bit, a couple of cell layers of granulation tissue underneath in order to secure it. Don't do that, okay? Because what you wind up with is this, and this is just misery. This happened to be colon, and that we thought we were just going a couple of cell layers into the granulation tissue in order to hold that skin graft down. But we found out as we went a few cell layers into the mucosa of the colon, that patient developed a fistula, and it was kind of a mess. Eventually got reconstructed, and it did well, but it's just very unpleasant. What are some of the ways that you can do this? If you wind up with one of these disasters, then you can use the wound vac is pretty helpful for this thing. I also will say that these pictures were sent to me. This was not one of my cases. Just throwing that out there. But you sort of prepare the abdomen, and then you put the sponge down. You cut a hole where the fistula is, put a bag on it, and then you can vac it. And it really works pretty well. Works probably about 3/4 of the time. Sometimes it just doesn't, and then you know, you just have to sort of put your big boy pants on and go and reoperate on these patients. But usually it works pretty well. Okay, so now it's time for stage three, and that's the definitive reconstruction of the abdominal wall. And there's a whole bunch of different techniques for doing this. We can use prosthetic materials, biomaterials, various muscle flaps, or separate the parts of the abdominal wall in order to try to reconstruct the abdomen. And there's advantages and disadvantages to both. Using some sort of prosthetic material or a biomaterial is pretty simple, but the disadvantages, especially if you've got a stoma that you need to close as well, you can wind up with infections, and hernia rates are reportedly are higher in patients with prosthetic materials. Biomaterials, for a while there, it sounded like this was really going to be the answer to this, but what we've discovered is that over time they stretch, and then the patient sort of looks like they did before, except they've got this big stretched biomaterial, which makes it look like they still have a large hernia. Use of muscle flaps are fairly complex, and there's not really a whole lot of experience with that. But most of the experience is with components and the modified component separation, which is what I'll show you here in a minute. Why should you wait a year? Why not just do this right off the front end? Well, some places do that. We've not really embraced that particular management scheme, typically because these patients are still pretty sick. They typically have a fair amount of abdominal wall edema, and their tissues are not really very pliable. So in order to try to perform a definitive reconstruction on patients still with edematous tissues and not pliable abdominal wall, I think it sort of sets you up for potential disaster on down the road. So in those patients, we don't acutely reconstruct those patients for those reasons. What about just putting a piece of biomaterial over this? It doesn't really work very well. Sometimes some of the plastic surgeons have done this, but in the overall scheme of things, it's not particularly beneficial, again, for all the reasons that I told you. There's probably a few subsets of patients who could benefit from this, but at least in these trauma and these massive resuscitation patients, probably doesn't really work very well. So what about recurrence rates that have been reported for some, and again, I'm not talking about the small incisional hernias, I'm talking about these giant ventral hernias. Recurrence rates are pretty substantial, with a mean of about 23% with varying times of follow-up, a little over 2 years, from a bunch of different investigators. So again, due to this, why is there such variability? Well, if you close something under tension, it's likely to break down. If you use a mesh bridge, then you can get some misery that's associated with that. If you use either mesh over or underlay, you have the potential for infection. And then with the biomaterial bridge, they wind up stretching. So there's lots of reasons why these recurrence rates are so high. But the good news about this is you really don't have to be the best thing in the world. You just have to be better than somebody else, right? So it's like if you're deep sea diving and up comes a shark, you take your knife and you stab your buddy in the leg so that you get away. Nah, I'm kidding about that. But again, you don't really have to be as fast as the cheetah. You just have to be faster than the slowest gazelle. Now, component separation is pretty nice way to address these particular hernias because you're using the patient's native tissue. Obviously, it doesn't work quite as well in patients who've had abdominal wall loss, but once the edema goes down and the abdominal wall is far more pliable, then it works really pretty well. So the first thing we do is raise some skin flaps and release the external oblique, and that winds up getting you about 3 to 5 centimeters or so on either side. You take the external oblique and you grasp it with some Allis clamps and go ahead and dissect it. Usually you can do it with your hand off the internal oblique all the way down to the operating room table, and it works really pretty well. Sometimes you can get the abdomen closed with that, recurrence rates are a bit variable, and for larger defects, it doesn't really work. So we described this method in the mid-90s, which is the modification of the component separation, and that's where we do component separation, which again is division of the external oblique. Then we dissect the posterior sheath from the rectus and then divide the anterior component of the internal oblique, right? You remember how the internal oblique splits, so we divide the anterior component of the internal oblique. Obviously, you can't go below the arcuate line because then you create a defect there, so you stay above the arcuate line. And this winds up, this is what it looks like. See, here's posterior sheath dissected through, and then there's the anterior. See, there's where the internal oblique divides. There's the anterior division of that anterior oblique, or of the internal oblique. And then we sew the medial border of the posterior sheath to the lateral border of the anterior sheath. And magically, that closes the abdominal wall. And that'll give you about 10 to 15 centimeters on either side. So that really works pretty well for these giant hernias that we're talking about. And Free Louis can avoid the use of the prosthetic. Again, these are the sorts of defects that I'm talking about. This is skin graft over the bowels. And just a few videos on how this works. The time to do this is when you can easily pinch the skin graft off the underlying viscera. That's when you know you're ready to go. But if it takes longer than a year, then forget it. It's not going to get any better after a year. It's not going to loosen up anymore. So a year should be the maximum time that you do. Now this demonstrates, see, we've raised skin flaps here, and now we're dividing the external oblique. And graphically, this is what it looks like up here. This is where we are dividing the external oblique. Here, mobilizing the posterior sheath from the rectus. Here's the rectus muscle there, and that's the posterior sheath. And again, graphically, this is what it looks like. So there's posterior sheath all completely separated there. Okay. Now you stick the way to do this part is you stick your hand in and you grab the rectus. And so then the only thing that you can feel that's the lateral border of the rectus, when you feel your fingers, the only thing that's holding you there is the anterior component of the internal oblique. So just bovie right down on your fingers, and that puts you through there. So now we have rectus with its anterior sheath covered that's completely disconnected, except up at the cephalad, it's connected at the rib cage, and then caudate, it's still connected because you're just above the arcuate line. Okay, so then at this point, we sew the medial border of the posterior sheath, which is A, is sewn to, well, that's the midline, but you sew B to B primed, medial border of the posterior sheath, the lateral border of the anterior sheath. Now, I'm sure you've thought, well, there's no way that can work because you've got things that are on different planes, right? And that does create a weak spot inferiorly and superiorly where you're bringing the posterior sheath up to sew it to the lateral border of the anterior sheath. So you've got different planes, and you had to just put sort of a figure of eight, and that's the way we do it, is I put a figure of eight suture, both cephalad and caudad, and then just run those two. You just have to sort of glom up where the fascia comes in at a different plane, and it works. It creates a weak spot, a potential weak spot, and we have had recurrences there until we started putting figure of eights and sort of get a deeper bite back into the more tissue in order to smash those two together, and it really works pretty well. Then this demonstrates the completed repair. There's the midline, and then that's posterior sheath, right there. That's the posterior sheath right there. And then we sew the drains in. So it's a great operation. Does it work? Well, this is what it looks like. This is what the guy looked like. So we looked at 150 patients to see if, in fact, this really worked. We lost 40 to follow-up. So we got long-term follow-up on 114 patients, which is a reasonable number given that. It's about 75%, not too bad. 98% of those had successful repair. We had 16 recurrences, and of those, 11 underwent salvage repair. Most of these recurrences occurred, again, in those weak spots that I told you, and in the upper abdomen, in the upper midline. So we looked at all the different ways that these patients were reconstructed, and they were either reconstructed with no separation of the abdominal wall parts, plus or minus a prosthetic, standard component separation as described by Ramirez, plus or minus prosthetic, and then the modified component separation, plus or minus a prosthetic, which is just the video that I just showed you. So again, 114 patients, most of them male, most of them following penetrating trauma with shock and resuscitation. The mean defect size was 620 square centimeters. And if you remember one of the earlier studies that showed they could get 88% of these these closed with delayed fascial closure, their mean defect was only about 260 square centimeters. So these are big defects that we're talking about. And I show this not to just to show you all the things that we looked at, but to show that there's clinically really no difference among all these various risk factors for recurrence with the different methods that were treated. And the most common thing that we did was the modified component separation. Again, here are the methods of repair. No separation of parts with and without a prosthetic, component separation without and with a prosthetic, and then modified components. Still, even after doing modified components, there were still a number of patients that still required a prosthetic in order to achieve a tension-free closure. And the most common place to need the prosthetic is in the upper midline. Depending on a patient's costal margins, whether it's wide or narrow, that's just the most common place. This demonstrates the recurrence rates for each method of repair. So If we didn't separate the abdominal wall parts but used the prosthetic, a third of those recurred, 44% of those components with the prosthetic recurred, and then 20% of the modified components with the prosthetic recurred. But if you're able to get tissue repair, that had pretty low recurrence rates. So that made us think, gee, I wonder if maybe some of these no separation of parts would have done better had we canned the prosthetic and then just done a full component separation on these patients. And then maybe some of these 44% recurrence, maybe they would have done better if we would have just forgotten the prosthetic and gone on a modified component separation repair. I don't know. It's an intriguing thought, and it certainly looks like that might be the case, but kind of difficult to tell. So when do we do this? As I mentioned earlier, the timing really matters, because if you wait much longer than a year, then you wind up really losing domain, and then you wind up having to use a prosthetic. So it's best to get these patients done within a year. Now, if we look at the follow-up from this particular study, and this was a slide I showed you earlier, 2-year follow-up versus 5-year follow-up, and the overall recurrence rate was 14% versus 23%, and that's a statistically significant difference compared to the accumulation of all the other studies. And this is a Kaplan-Meier graph of the timing of the recurrence in our particular study. This red line demonstrates the times of recurrence, the mean time of recurrence, and all the previously reported literature. So they would have missed all these. We had a substantial number of recurrences that occurred on farther out from the injury. So I think that the reported recurrence rates in the literature are probably a little bit on the low side, because they didn't follow these patients out for quite as long. So really, there's probably higher recurrence rates. This is a patient who came back to clinic who was very upset that he had to have this operation through his tattoo, which was on there in honor of his brother who had died. So we took great pains to try to reconstruct him and to recreate his tattoo. And this is a happy guy in clinic. And in fact, even Kat Von D approved of this particular reconstruction. So in summary, it's clear that open abdomen save lives, right? So the days of trying to wench someone closed are really not very good. Small bowel fistulas are associated with prolonged time to abdominal wall coverage. Optimal time for reconstruction of the abdominal wall is anywhere from 8 to 12 months or so to avoid the loss of domain. Try to cover the mesh as best you can. And what we found is that the lowest long-term recurrence rates seem to occur with patients who have modified component separation techniques. I'll leave with this thought from Stevie Wonder. I can't really sum it up any better than him. Thank you very much for the privilege of the floor.
Never a dull moment with Dr. Croach.